Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table,
a new United Methodist community of faith taking shape at Central UMC in Sacramento, California.
The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Duhirsu,
with a musical introduction by Anthony Coleman, our director of music.
Thanks for listening.
This morning comes from the sixth chapter of John, verses 1 through 14. After this, Jesus went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, also called the Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd kept following him because they saw the signs that he was doing for the sick. Jesus went up the mountain and sat down there with the disciples. Now the Passover, the festival of the Jews, was near. When he looked up and saw a large crowd coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread for these people to eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he was going to do. Philip answered him, "6 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little." One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they among so many people?" And Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." Now there was a great deal of grass in the place, so they sat down, about 5,000 in all. Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. When they were satisfied, he told his disciples, "Gather up the fragments left over, so that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up, and from the fragments of the 5 barley loaves, left by those who had eaten, they filled 12 baskets. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they began to say, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world."
It's fabulous, these Olympics. 2 billion of us are tuned in right now worldwide. And I loved Anne Lamott, her Facebook post this week. I'm going to read it for you in part. She says, "It is so great to watch this collective show of greatness as a salve to our minds and spirits, like when a few billion of us get to watch a solar eclipse together. It's as though a hush falls over the whole world like a mantilla, and then gasps of amazement roll out, and gratitude to be out of the prison of our thinking and our self-absorption and our anxiety and our greed. Over the coming weeks, we will watch the Olympics together, holding our one great human breath, cheering others on." I love that. And that's what we'll do here, too. We're going to travel, as Matt said, over these 3 weeks, and today I'm going to talk a little bit about Olympic messes. And I'm going to just open with a mess that has been etched in my memory from as far back as I can remember. It was actually not the Olympics. It was leading up to the 1976 Olympics. I'm old, so I go back further than some people. And there was this great Olympic gymnast, Lyudmila Taryshcheva. Does anybody remember her? You don't, right? Because you remember Olga Korbut. She came after Lyudmila, and Lyudmila was this fabulous, wonderful Soviet gymnast with such poise and such dignity, and it was the 70s. I was scared to death of Russia, right? I thought they were going to kill us at any time. So when the Soviets came on, and they were such wonderful gymnasts, which was the sport that I hung out with at school. I didn't do it myself, but my best friend did. I was so enamored of that. And Lyudmila She is one of only two women in history. This is trivia. You could win something with this, probably. So she is only one of two women that's ever had the Grand Slam of gymnastics. That means, the Grand Slam means you win all of the events in every single one of the tournaments. So she has been the all-around Olympic gymnast champion for the Olympics, the World Champs, the World Cup, and the European Championships. There's only two women that could pull that off. Do you get how great she is? All right, so this is Ludmilla. We're gonna show, it's old. Look what happened.
I mean, Tarasova's control was immense. I mean, we had the example at the World Cup at Wembley when she came off the asymmetric bars, and as she dismounted off it, the bars collapsed.
And the apparatus has collapsed.
And she didn't really look behind to see what was happening, because as far as she was concerned, you know, that was irrelevant to the performance that she'd just done.
I wonder whether the judges will...
The discipline of that athlete was unbelievable.
Isn't she phenomenal? She doesn't even look back. Some of you don't know that that's what the parallel bars used to look like. I know. It was huge, and she won. She won it all and never looked back and would not even speak of that mess that she left behind her. Historically speaking, the Olympics brings forward for us some of the most incredible displays of human venture. And they show us, you know, the best and the worst of what can happen, most especially around our nationalism, right? Because we're all competing as countries. So let's just think of some of the worst displays for a moment. I think of Berlin in 1936. We did the Olympics under a Nazi regime. It was horrible. It was horrible, and we treated people very badly, most especially our Jewish brothers and sisters. There was Munich in 1972, and in those Olympics, bad people came and people got hurt and some people even died. That's not what the Olympics is for. And those are some scary things, but there are also some other wonderful things, and hopefully we're thinking that London will allow us to witness that. We've already seen a little bit, and what I mean by that is the people who come into the stadium already, we get to see the diversity and nations and displays of human rights. It looks like a parade. But what we are seeing often are revolutionary moments right there in front of us. I'm gonna say just a few. So, when women marched in to the stadium on Friday night from Brunei, I don't know if I'm saying that right, Brunei, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, that was the first time women have ever come from those countries. Huge and enormous. And if someone says to you, oh, that's just a token, it was just one, just remember 2 billion people saw them do that. 2 billion people, a lot of them girls from those countries, quite possibly, who say, well, she did it, I can too. And lest we also forget our own country, this is the first time we have had men and women on our team, but this is the first time women have outnumbered the men on the U.S. Olympic team. That's kind of amazing too. We also have in that stadium phenomenal athletes who have defined courage in their own countries. The fastest sprinter in Egypt's history, his name is Amir Saoud, and he was among the first protesters to arrive at Tahrir Square in Cairo. An amazing man. So on the morning of January 25th, 2011, this Olympian ran to the square to denounce the police abuses and 3 decades of emergency laws that had allowed indefinite detention of other human beings without having any right to trial in his country. And that happened for 29 years under Hosni Mubarak. This is a man who's training for the Olympics. It's close to his heart, but he risks life and limb. and he runs to the square. 3 days later, he's standing on the side of the road speaking to his neighbor, and sniper bullets that are meant from an ambulance that were going by killed the man next to him, his neighbor. Clearly, the athletes that come to these games rise from some of the best, but a lot of the worst circumstances and human conditions in our world. There's a man named Craig Neff, and he covers the Olympics for Sports Illustrated. He's done that for a while. And he posited that these games that we're watching right now might be considered transitional Olympics, maybe even transformative Olympics, because we're seeing the last of certain great stars. I think Michael Phelps has had his day, and bless him, he's moving on. And maybe there'll be others. We never know, right, like him. We also are seeing the last of traditional Western host cities in London. From here, the games go to Brazil and then to South Korea, and maybe we're going to Istanbul in 2020. So for the Olympics to venture into new Russia, South America, and maybe a Muslim country, it signals as big a global shift as happened when we went to China, which wasn't that long ago. So these huge shifts in our world history are happening faster and closer together. It's often this kind of shift in human drama that leads us from Olympic glory, though, into these huge Olympic messes. And already there have been a few. Now, I really do follow this, so I don't know if you know that, and I follow soccer a little bit more than other things. The North Korea Olympic women's soccer team, did you hear? They put the wrong flag up. They put South Korea's flag up. So they refused to take the pitch. They said, we're not going to play. And the game was delayed for an hour, and they walked off the pitch, and official apology was made, and they said it wasn't done on purpose, the Olympic Committee, but it said this: we have made a full apology to the team, the North Korean National Olympic Committee. A genuine mistake has been made, for which we apologize. The full thing said apologize, I think, seven times I counted. Those two Koreas, for some of our friends who don't know, North and South, are divided by the world's most militarized border ever. And they remain technically at war with each other. So that was a huge, huge insult. Also, did anybody watch the opening ceremonies? Anyone in the room? Yeah, a few of us. Oh my gosh. Well, one of the best parts we found out was left out. While America watched Ryan Seacrest interview Michael Phelps, the rest of the world saw a phenomenal tribute to fallen terrorist victims, most especially those few that had died. 52 lives were lost in London the day after they announced that London was going to have the Olympics. They did a full tribute. It's the most phenomenal dance. And the part of how, the real reason I found it is the next morning I go to the playlist, you can go to playlist very quick, and they had Abide With Me on the Olympic soundtrack. I'm going, they didn't play Abide With Me? That's a hymn in our hymnal, number 700, I think. Well, that was what they danced to as they lifted up those fallen people. And hundreds were hurt as well. So if you want to see that, we'll post a link to it, and it's on the BBC network. I don't know if that was intentional or not. There's no way to say, but it seems like a big mess to me. And there's going to be a whole lot more in the days to come. I already mentioned the black eye, and now soccer women are fighting. You know, these are Brandi Chastain, and it's bad. It's messy. But it's what happens when human beings get together and we have our hearts outside of our bodies and we're competing at the level that we want to in our world. We've heard about all of these stories, and I also hope you heard the story that Matt read, because in some ways you might call feeding 5,000 people an Olympic event. Feeding 5,000 people. I have I don't feed five people. Mark feeds five people. Let's be clear. 5,000 would put me completely over the edge. So the passage that we heard is pretty familiar, because this is one of those that's in every one of the Gospels in our Bible. And some people call it the feeding of the 4,000, the feeding of the 5,000, loaves and fishes, the miracle of the bread and the fish. There are many ways to refer to it. This morning, we get to hear the version from the Gospel of John. And I'm just going to first say, let's look at a wide angle view of this. Right? Let's step back a little bit. And I want to remind us what might be unique to hearing this story in the Gospel of John. We want to remember that to John, what's important is the incarnation. And what that means is the divinity, the holiness and the divinity of God is born into the world in this man named Jesus. And that's why this Gospel begins with these words: in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's incarnation. And then the Word becomes flesh and lives among us. One might claim, as does the New Interpreter's Bible, that these verses, these words that I just said, are the foundation on which the rest of the whole Gospel of John is built. So we want to hold that when we hear this story of feeding loaves and fishes and 5,000 people, that John's version is that Jesus is the incarnate Word of God living on earth. Another way of saying that is that Jesus gives us access to God, the story of Jesus, in ways that maybe are never before thought possible for human beings, because Jesus is so close to God and we get to watch and learn from him in ways that we didn't know before. Another way of thinking about it is that Jesus brings God fully into the world. In John, Jesus is God's Word. Any of those ways might help you think about what is Jesus doing in this story and why is it important. So that's the wide angle. So let's go in for a close-up shot, you know, like they do in the Olympics, and that boom camera comes down. And we see in this story Jesus and the disciples trying to get away. That was in Matt's sermon last week. They want to go away and take a break and pray. But thousands of people gather to come close and to watch and to learn. Nobody put up bleachers for them. They just showed up. And Jesus on the mountain comes down trying to rest and thinks, oh, we have to teach these people. And thus unfolds this mess before us. Maybe we can imagine the commentary. He's coming down the mountain now. The crowd is starting to buzz. He's approaching those disciples. They look confused, the disciples. They're gesturing to this crowd of people. You have to wonder, what are they saying? Look at Jesus' face. He looks so calm. Nothing phases this man. He must have a phenomenal warm-up routine. There must be a concern for him, for all these people gathered. What do we think is in his mind? This wasn't planned as an event, was it? It's not on my Olympic program. What is going to happen? It looks like Philip and Andrew have broken off from the 12, and they're putting their heads together, strategizing on the side. And we have movement. Jesus has clearly given some kind of instruction. We can't really hear what is going to happen. I don't know why these two who are so close to him can't figure it out for themselves. Clearly their training regime needs some amping up. Oh, I see. Jesus is in charge here. He's directing his team. He's making things happen. He is the man in charge. And the people get fed. 5,000 strong. The people get fed, 5,000 strong, so well that there's leftovers. Leftovers, and Jesus shows what? Concern for those 5,000? No, concern for the leftovers. Well, that's interesting. Concern for the leftovers, and he says, gather us the fragments that are left over so that nothing may be lost. So directed again, that's what they do. And from those fragments, it records five barley loaves left over, enough to fill 12 baskets of bread. Well, of course, I'm having fun with this. So I'm imagining the post-feeding interview, Bob Costas coming down. Jesus doesn't recognize him because he's had so much work done on his face. I can't even believe that. I know, it was strange. But Bob puts the mic in his face and says, "I can't help noticing, Jesus, you just fed 5,000 people in record time and I'm fine.